Before we begin today's show, I want you to know about a free resource from Premier Insight that speaks to something many people are noticing in our culture right now. More and more, people are turning to things like manifestation, astrology, meditation, and other spiritual practices, often because they're searching for meaning, purpose, and connection. That longing is what Bell Tyndall Riley calls the sacred ache. That's why we're offering a free chapter download from The Sacred Ache, exploring modern spirituality and how these deeper longings ultimately point us towards God. You can get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now, it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we're going to be doing one of our periodic kind of step backs from the tumult of technological and scientific progress and the dizzying breakneck speed of our society's innovations and to look at a particular theological issue which informs a lot of what we think as Christians, how we're going to be guided in responding to some of these newer questions. And today's kind of theological framework we want to dive into a little bit is the image of God, sometimes called in Ponzi Latin language, the Imago Dei. Am I saying that right?
Imago Dei, that's right. Although, of course, it's Hebrew in which the first use of that concept was, and the Hebrew is Tselem.
And that's from Genesis 1, isn't it? Genesis 1, verses 26. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and over all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And this is clearly an idea that I would imagine everyone who's a Christian has heard of before. It comes up a lot in kind of teaching and things like that. And it's often something that is relied on, I think, in a lot of these ethical conversations that we have on this podcast and others have beyond, about whether it might be artificial intelligence or abortion or some other ethical concern. People often talk about the image of God, but there's sometimes a lack of clarity about what exactly we mean by the image of God, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, it has always been a very central part of a Christian understanding of what it means to be human. And it does appear in the scriptures, although it's quite interesting that when you look across the whole biblical narrative, references to human beings as being made in the image of God are actually very scarce. There are a handful of references early on in Genesis, and then it seems that concept really doesn't reappear throughout the whole of the Old Testament. So it's one of the just fascinating side points is that I've discovered that in Orthodox Jewish thinking, and you know, the rabbis who immerse themselves totally in the Hebrew scriptures, they don't put a lot of emphasis on this image theology. They recognize it's there, but it isn't seen as a central part of their understanding of what it means to be human. Whereas right from the New Testament, I think, the understanding that of human beings made in God's image has been a very central part of Christian understanding.
But interestingly, even when you look through the New Testament, the language where it does appear almost always is actually talking about Jesus rather than the rest of us. You know, so there are a number of references to Jesus being the kind of image of the invisible God in Colossians and in Hebrews and places like that. So it seems to be that, again, is that the theology being developed or just being applied slightly differently?
Yeah, so in the Old Testament, the same word tselem is used largely of idols. It's their graven images. Mm. It's almost as though once the fall happens, the focus on the use of that word is much more related to idolatry, to graven false images, rather than it is on human beings that are still bearing the image. Although there is one crucial reference in Genesis 9, and one that I've often made use of in my own, you know, in bioethics, where the taboo against killing, if man sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, in other words, capital punishment, the justification that's given is because in the image of God has God made man. So the divine image is linked directly to that taboo on murder. And I think it's perfectly justified to extend that to say there is a protection on all human life because of the image.
And so I guess, like I said, it's easy to kind of trot out, well, of course, you know, as we know, human beings are made in the image of God, but not very often do we kind of pause and say, well, what does that actually mean? Because, I mean, you know, to state the obvious, it's not literally that we look like God, because the Bible tells us elsewhere that, you know, God the Father is formless and invisible and spirit, and clearly we are physical and tangible and material. And so it's not that God, I don't think, it's not that God has, you know, two arms and is bipedal and is between, you know, 5 and 6 feet tall and has two eyes and hair only on top of his head. It's something richer than that, but we don't often actually consider what it means in a metaphorical sense to be made in God's image.
That's absolutely right. And I think that's a bit of a danger, isn't it? That people just trot out, oh, well, of course, human beings are made in God's image, as though that is a kind of knockdown answer to every problem, while they have only the haziest understanding of what that might mean.
Exactly.
And it is true to say that, you know, theologians have wrestled with this topic for 2,000 years, you know, going all the way back to the church fathers. And there is not a generally agreed conclusion amongst all theologians about precisely what this term refers to. And I think you can trace at least four different themes, groups of understanding about what this phrase means.
Are you building up to announcing that you have solved the problem 2,000 years later? John Wyatt has finally going to draw a line under this discussion and announce on this very podcast what it means to be made in the image of God.
No, well, as you've worked out, Tim, I'm a kind of mealy-mouthed, middle-of-the-road, kind of inoffensive sort of person. So I'm going to come to the stunning conclusion that actually it's a bit of all four.
Coward. Intellectual cowardice of the highest order. Okay, fair enough. Let's run through those four big ideas then and see what we make of them. What's the first one?
Okay, the first one comes from the actual Hebrew of that in Genesis 1 and is the one that is favoured by most Hebrew scholars of the ancient Middle East. What they say is that in the culture of the time, it was often said that the image, the king who ruled over a land would have his representatives, vicegerents, who were human beings who represented the king. And they were often in the ancient language described as being in the image of the king, because wherever they went, whatever they said, they carried the authority of the king himself. These Hebrew scholars say it's that kind of understanding, therefore, that the original readers of Genesis would have naturally assumed that when it said that human beings were made in God's image, that human beings were therefore God's representatives on earth, the vicegerent, the ones who carried out God's purposes and plans on the earth. And they then point to the fact that when in that verse in Genesis 1:26, having said, let us make human beings in our image, God immediately says, let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So there's a direct link between being made in God's image and ruling over the earth.
Yeah, and it's repeated, isn't it? Because then in verse 27, it says, you know, and God created humans in his own image, male and female. And then verse 28, God blessed them and says to them, be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over living creatures. So it's a repetition there, which seems to be fairly strong evidence, the idea that in the writer of Genesis's mind, there is a connection between being made in the image and ruling over, stepping into God's role as kind of exercising a degree of sovereignty, dominion over the rest of created order, which is not made in God's image.
Absolutely. And I think I absolutely wouldn't want to deny that in any sense, that clearly is very strongly part of what it means, that we are called to represent God. Now, it's often been said by secular critics. I think Lynn White was one of the first people who made a direct link between this verse and then the fact that humans have exploited the creation and the kind of ecological disaster that has happened from the way humans have treated the natural world. And it has been claimed that people have, it's this Christian understanding that we are have complete rights over the rest of the creation that has led to the ecological disaster.
Mm. Given unfettered rein to the kind of rapaciousness of humans, you know, and you see that there are still echoes of that in some Christian thinking today. You know, I've heard sermons where people have kind of made sideways remarks about, well, you know, of course, we can kind of do what we want on God's earth because he's given us this dominion and what our job is to rule, and, you know, kind of the belief that we've been set up as kind of demigods, you know, within the sovereignty of God to do what we like on this earth, and therefore we can exploit and twist and reshape and form and do whatever we like because creation answers to us and then we answer to God or something like that.
Yeah, but it's clear that that's a massive distortion of the biblical understanding of the human role within creation, you know, we're called to care for and tend and protect the natural world in the way that God himself has cared for and tended and protected it. It's, in other words, we're to carry on his own beneficent, caring rule. God doesn't exploit and damage and maltreat his own creation, and therefore he calls us to care for it with that same kind of beneficent care.
And this is where the kind of language of stewardship often is brought in, isn't it? And that's an image of, you know, the steward is, in similarly, is this kind of representative of the owner of, let's say, the vineyard or the farm, where the owner has gone away and the steward is delegated some level of responsibility, but clearly the steward must hand back the vineyard or the farm to the actual owner in good, if not better condition than they found it in. And they have a responsibility not just to squeeze what they can out of it for their own personal gain, but to rule it on behalf of the actual owner, creator.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, that's an image that Jesus uses in the New Testament, doesn't he? And that we're going to be held to account for how we've carried out our stewardship over the earth. But so... But nonetheless, I think, one of the things that this verse, if we take that image seriously, is that it does put a distinction between the human species and other species on the planet, that we have a responsibility to rule over them, but to rule over them appropriately and with due care, concern, and protection.
And one of the other benefits of this understanding of the Imago Dei, I suppose, is that it neatly sidesteps the problem of getting kind of bogged down in what does it look like, you know. And so, you know, as we'll come to, other understandings might explore things like particular attributes that we have which reflect God's, or particular ways of being that we are and which reflects God. And that often gets kind of bogged down in discussions about, well, what about this kind of person? They don't have that attribute. Are they in the image of God? Or whereas if you say the image of God is fundamentally about a calling, it's about a function, it's about a responsibility we've been given, it's not because there's anything particularly remarkable or special or distinctive about human beings compared to other parts of God's creation. It's just that God in his wisdom gave us this particular calling. It kind of avoids the problem of kind of, you know, because people often said, oh, the thing that distinguishes us from every animals is X. And then suddenly we discover, oh, no, there's an animal somewhere that can do X, you know, or there's a computer that can do X. And now we have to redefine it. And you have this, sometimes called the human of the gaps, you know, where you're trying to find the gaps between what we can and can't do. And that is somehow definitive of what it means to be a human.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think that it is a helpful reminder that rather than always been trying to focus on what is different in terms of our capabilities and capacities, it's our calling. What are we here for? What are we put on the planet for? And you know, that takes us to the creation mandates, which we've talked about previously in podcasts, that we're called to rule over the earth and to subdue it, to make it become fruitful. And in Genesis 2, we have the image that God creates the garden, but then makes the humans to cultivate it, to bring forth the potential. Similar kind of idea then, isn't it?
Yeah. And for those interested in a kind of longer discussion of this, we did a podcast a few years ago with a theologian who's got much bigger brain on this than either of us, I think you would agree, called Andrew Davison. Yeah. And that was actually about looking in particular at intelligent life forms we might discover in the future in space. And he's written a book about astrobiology and Christian theology. But we had this conversation about the image of God in that sense, and is it how it might be defined as functional calling as opposed to attributes. And so, yeah, just want to flag that. That's an interesting conversation. If you want to dig into that, go scroll up the feed a few years and find, I think it's called Space Exploration or something like that, with Andrew Davison in the feed.
Yeah. Why don't we put it in the show notes? I think I agree. It's a fascinating take on the what are the distinctives of the human if the whole cosmos is full of utter intelligent beings.
Indeed.
Okay, shall we move on to number two?
Yeah, what's
which
number
is
two?
Much, we've already flagged it up in a way. It is about the capacities, the unique capacities that human beings have and which reflect the being of God, the capacities that God has. And so this is when people have often laid particular emphasis in the past on rationality, that and this is possibly because Christian thinking was strongly influenced by Greek philosophy, which put a huge emphasis on rationality as being the most important attribute of human beings. And so it's often said that human beings are the only rational animal. And because God himself is rational, our rationality reflects the character of God. Then other things like creativity, like language, like the ability to procreate and engage in relationships, and our spiritual awareness. You know, it's often said we're the only upright primate that looks to the skies everywhere. All the other animals look down to the ground. Not quite true of the birds, but never mind.
Yeah, or, you know, giraffes or something like that. But anyway, yes. And I think that, you know, there seems to be some interesting merit to this idea that if we are made in God's image, then we may not physically resemble him, as previously discussed. God is spirit. But we might resemble his personality, his character, his attributes. The things that make God God are those some things that he's kind of seeded into the fiber of what it means to be human in a way that a chimpanzee or a tree doesn't have. That doesn't seem to be obviously stupid to me anyway.
No, indeed. And I'm sure, again, I want to be mealy-mouthed and say there's an element of it that is true. But there's an immediate problem for it, and particularly very much something I, as a paediatrician, have had to wrestle with. And that is, you know, over my career, I've cared for so many human beings made in God's image who have been tragically brain damaged or subject to very, very severe congenital malformations. So that all these things, all these attributes, just can't be expressed in their lives. And so then if we put all the emphasis on rationality and on language and creativity, what happens to those human beings made in God's image who aren't able to speak, who, because such severity of brain damage, they're not rational. They're not able to be creative in any normally recognizable sense. Mm. You know, do we say that they are less human?
Yeah.
That they don't reflect God's image?
And that's an idea that I think most Christians would kind of instinctively revolt against, the idea that another human being might not be made in God's image because they can't express creativity, language, rationality, spirituality, or any of these other attributes. I think we all instinctively feel in our bones that there's something intrinsic about being human which supersedes and which transcends your mere abilities or capacities. That's probably under threat as an idea, isn't it, from more kind of utilitarian philosophies.
Some people have argued that, okay, the brain-damaged human being can't do all things, but they have the potential to do this. The humanity still carries a potential. But I don't find that persuasive, I have to say, personally. And certainly, as I've observed parents loving their profoundly damaged children, caring for them, tenderly respecting them, treating them as their lovely child, however much deeply affected by brain damage or whatever, I simply revolt against the idea that that means that in some sense they're less than human, and therefore that the image of God is preserved despite profound illness affecting the brain and the other organs.
Yeah. And it seems you don't have to look too hard to find lots of examples of cultures and societies that are profoundly unchristian or kind of pre-Christian, where they very much did determine the nature of someone's, you know, whether they recognized a person as being, you know, an equal member of the human family or not, wasn't their attributes. You know, the classic example might be, you know, ancient Sparta, where they would examine babies born, and if they were deformed or in some way didn't meet up the ideal, they would just throw them and discard them and let them die of exposure. And that wasn't seen as a kind of harsh discipline. That was just, well, they weren't human, so why would we treat them like other humans? That's not an uncommon idea in cultures and societies which haven't drawn on this idea of the Imago Dei being present in everyone, irrespective of our abilities and capacities.
Fascinatingly, pretty well all non-Christian cultures, if you go back historically, practiced various forms of infanticide and child and baby killing. That's why that when the Christians came along and started rescuing abandoned babies and were known as the people who protected and cared for even abnormal and disabled babies, this was regarded as completely novel and surprising, and even contrary to nature. So there is a very strong and rich Christian tradition right from the beginning of understanding that even the most vulnerable and weak members of the human race are still of unique value. Of course, a lot of that goes back to the doctrine of the incarnation, the fact that God himself turned himself into a pathetic baby and who depended on others. was so deeply shocking in the ancient world, that idea, you know, but it's had enormous ramifications.
Hmm. Do we know if they ever drew on the idea of the image of God in explaining why they did that? Have you read anything from early church writings which might also draw on the Imago Dei?
Yes, they did. There are writings from the period, the first centuries of Christianity, when exactly this was going on, which do refer to human beings made in God's image. Again, I have written about this before, and I'll see if I can dig out and put it in the show notes.
I guess in some ways that's a kind of reversal of that prohibition, the blood taboo in Genesis 9. You know, if you must not take the life, spill the blood of another person because they bear the image, the flip side is you must therefore also prevent another human being, even a child, from coming to harm and from dying because they bear the image. It's a kind of logical corollary of the blood taboo.
That's exactly right. And so the early Christians saw both abortion and infanticide as something that they were totally opposed to. But what was so moving to me is that they didn't engage in great song demonstrations and rhetoric. They just set about practically rescuing abandoned babies. And
over time became so famous for it that people actually would bring babies to their doors of early Christian communities, I understand, because they were known that if you didn't or couldn't look after your child, you could dump it with these Christians and know that it would be raised well.
Absolutely. And the early Christian churches had so many blooming children that had been rescued that they had to have special places called brefatoria, where they looked after, you know, all the babies that were being steadfastly rescued.
Okay, should we draw a line there on number two, the kind of attributes, capacities of humankind reflecting God as being what the image of God is? What is the third way that people have understood the Imago Dei?
So the third way, which has been emphasised particularly in the 20th century by a number of theologians, including Karl Barth, puts the emphasis much more on the relationality. So what they point to, first of all, in Genesis 26, is that the wording is different. When in the creation of human beings, is different from the creation of all other animals. So in the creation of all other animals, it's let the land bring forth living creatures. It's in that passive.
Yeah.
But when it comes to human beings, it says, let us make man in our image. And when we read that, most Christian theologians have read that with Trinitarian eyes and said, what is happening is that let us is the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, three persons in one. Let us make human beings in our image. And verse 27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. So they say it is the male and femaleness. It is together as male and female in relation that we image the God who is in relation.
And so there's the idea here is this kind of fundamental complementarity between men and women, and it's them together that they somehow, I mean, is that ultimately in marriage, you know, or is it just in general that mankind, humankind, falls into two sexes and together we image, is always about the particular one man, one woman coming together in marriage that constitutes God?
Yeah, I mean, it obviously isn't. Otherwise, you're saying that people aren't married are less than human, and yet Jesus wasn't married. So it's much more to do with the fact that we cannot be human alone. We are only human in relation. And that's partly expressed in our masculinity and femininity, but it's more generally expressed in our relationality. It is relationality that constitutes our humanity, and it therefore constitutes the Imago Dei. And of course, that is very different from emphasizing something like rationality. You know, it's often been said that it was the ancient theologians sitting in their studies, you know, alone, thinking furiously, saying, well, who's the most highest human being? Well, it's obviously it's a philosopher, a theologian like me, isn't it? Someone who thinks. That's the highest kind of being. Whereas the idea that actually we need one another, we're in relation, is central to our humanity, is a very deep thought.
And does that tie into kind of changing thinking around the Trinity? Because I'm very much out of my comfort zone here, but I'm vaguely aware that the 20th century was also the kind of flourishing of what's sometimes been called the social model of the Trinity, seeing the three persons fundamentally, understanding them not as kind of three types of God, but about how, you know, that it's about three persons in relationship with each other is what constitutes the Trinity.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, I personally think that there's calling that the social model is a very is a very reductionist language. I think it's much more profound than that. But it is the idea that the persons, the three persons of the Trinity, are in some profound sense dependent on each other for their being. So it's sometimes said that the Father could not be Father if the Son didn't exist. It would be meaningless to call the first person of the Trinity Father if the Son didn't exist. So the very being of the first person of the Trinity depends on the existence of the second person of the Trinity, and vice versa. So the persons are, personhood is an essential feature of the Godhead, and so that when that triune persons, the three in one, create a being in their own image, they create that being with personhood, which is constituted in relationality.
Have you ever wondered whether the stories of angels in the Bible are more than ancient history? What if they're still at work today? As our thanks for your gift to Premier Insight this month, we'd love to send you our exclusive ebook, The Case for Angels: Evidence, Encounters, and Scripture. You'll explore what the Bible really says about angels, discover compelling real-life accounts, and gain thoughtful answers to one of Christianity's most fascinating topics. Your generosity helps Premier Insight continue creating podcasts and resources that equip people to think biblically and engage today's biggest questions with confidence. Request your copy today at premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death. That's premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
What do you think are the strengths of this kind of relational understanding of the Imago Dei? What does it help? How does it help us explain or understand things that potentially the other approaches might be less good at?
Well, I find it very compelling because it does point to why self-giving, you know, the Greek word agape, self-giving love, love that gives to the other, why that is so centrally linked to our very nature as being made human. And it also, when I, you know, as I've observed the love being expressed between even a profoundly brain damaged child and the parents, it's a two-way process, and the giving and the receiving of love is something which is utterly undeniable and very, very moving.
And are there ways in which you think it's flawed or problems it needs to overcome, this relational model, or the ways in which it might be kind of misused and abused to deny the image of God in some people?
Well, again, we do know that there are some human beings who have extreme difficulty in establishing relationships, and who feel incapable of establishing the kind of deep self-giving bond with other human beings. And so if we exclusively focus on this aspect of the image, I think the danger is then that some people feel excluded because they cannot, they find it impossible to engage. And it might imply that single and isolated people are somehow less than fully human.
Yeah. I suppose there's a parallel there with when churches lean kind of too hard into the idea that, you know, procreation and, you know, the creation mandate is to have lots of children and fill the earth, and that defines what it means to be human. You know, there are grains of truth in that, but the risk is that if you push into that too hard, you end up tacitly saying to people who are celibate and single and childless for various reasons, are somehow falling short of their responsibilities or their calling or even their humanity.
Yes, and so it is possible for Christian communities to be rather heedless and insensitive towards many people in our society, in our community, and sometimes within our church communities, who find it exceedingly difficult to establish deep relationships with others. And so therefore putting exclusive focus on this, I think, is dangerous.
And last but not least, the fourth way, the fourth approach of understanding what it means to be made in the image of God.
Yes, and this is sometimes called the constitutive understanding of the image, that it's something which is just profoundly rooted in our being. That because we are created in God's image, we are locked into his being. Our being is locked into God's being, participates in God's being in a way which is almost too deep for words, but which cannot be destroyed. One way of expressing that is that to be made in God's image is to somehow participate in the divine life of the three in one. And I think that's related to the fact that whether we like it or not, we are known by God and we know God. I mean, many atheists would go at great length and say they don't know God, they don't believe God exists, you know, but the fact remains that they are known by God, and at some deep level, they know God. They cannot avoid God. They cannot run away from him. And so I'm particularly drawn out of the four, I'm particularly drawn to this one, because this is the one which, whatever happens to me and whatever happens to my brain and whatever happens to my relationships, nothing can destroy this constitutive nature of being locked into God's being. And the same is true for the profoundly damaged, disabled or malformed individuals who still know God and are known by God, and nothing can prevent that from happening.
Isn't this just really a clever, long-winded way of saying it is because it is because it is? I mean, if you're just saying the image of God is just the way that we are God-like in our very nature and essence, is just a kind of way of reframing the question. It's not really an answer. It's not about attributes, it's not about relationships, it's not about calling. It's just, it is because it is, and it's just there always, and it can't ever go away.
Yeah, to some extent, I think, but that doesn't mean to say it doesn't have profound content or meaning, because this way of thinking is also linked to the fact that Jesus is the supreme image of God, and that we are calling is to become like Jesus. And so this understanding of the image seems to me to link beautifully to this idea that the image of God is not just something which points back to how we were created, The image of God points forward. It's a promise of what we will be. When he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And so this idea that ultimately in glory, as human beings redeemed by Jesus, we will fully reflect, fully participate in the being of God.
And this brings us to a kind of another element we haven't really discussed yet, which is the imageness, for lack of a better phrase, is it something that is just kind of instantaneously granted or bestowed upon humans at the point of their creation, at the start of their existence? Or is it something that that can develop, that can, you know, am I today more in God's image than I was 10 years ago? And therefore, at the resurrection, will I become fully in the image of God? Is there a spectrum? Is there a shades of my image bearerness?
Yeah, I think there is. And there's a beautiful phrase. I don't know where this first came from, but it's something that I've often reflected about, that basically says, as human beings, we are in the process of becoming what we already are. So we're becoming full reflections of God, fuller reflections of God, which we already are. We are exploring and building up. And so the process of Christian formation, of Christian, sometimes called sanctification, is a process of becoming what we already are.
Does that potentially, unintentionally kind of undermine some of the things we've been trying to say earlier about the kind of image of God not being dependent on ourselves, not being contingent on what we can do and who we are and our context and our circumstances? But actually, if it is a spectrum, if we can become more in the image of God, then actually in some sense it is being tied to our, you know, what our spiritual formation, our personal development, our growth in integrity and character, the way that we are more reflecting God's own attributes in our day-to-day life. I mean, are you not introducing a degree of kind of contingency and basically the ability to kind of deny or strip away elements of others' image of Godness in them?
I don't think so. I mean, it's obviously that might be a danger, but that would be a huge abuse, I think, of this understanding of the doctrine. I think, in other words, there's an irreducible element to the image which can't be got rid of. But there's another element where we're called to grow into that image. I mean, you know, just take an analogy. You know, that's a bit close to home, actually, Tim. You're my son. So, like it or not, I can't get around that fact, you know. nothing can change the fact. Whatever you do, however you behave, you're my son. It's an irreducible fact that can't be changed. And yet, you could grow into becoming more like your old dad. You may think that that's something you really don't want to do. You
know? Actively striving in the opposite direction as it happens.
But, you know, the idea that you could become more of my son because you more reflect your old dad, whilst there's still an irreducible element that can't be changed. I mean, it's, you know, like all analogies, it breaks down, doesn't it? But there's something in
that. No, I can see that. Then that's helpful, actually, way of reframing it. And I suppose, as we've said many times, if you're kind of one of the lenses through which you want to interrogate each of these theologies of the Imago Dei is, you know, to what extent does this, with this, unintentionally exclude people whom society would like to exclude but whom Christians have always sought to include? This constitutive understanding of the Imago Dei, you know, is not difficult at all to say, well, of course, someone who's in a vegetative state can still they still reflect the image of God, even though they, you know, don't speak or move or engage in relationships or act with any creativity or personally try to live out the calling to subdue and have dominion over creation, that just because they're profoundly disabled or unable to think and move and act in the way that most of us are, that doesn't affect their fundamental status as an image bearer, because it's all about their dependence on the Creator.
Exactly. And therefore, I'm called to treat that being with wonder, with empathy, with respect, and with protection. And perhaps we should just try to earth it now with this high-flown theology. How does this actually relate to the nitty-gritty of the sort of bioethics and practical real-world decisions? And certainly it seems to me that one way in which it fleshes out is this belief that because human beings, all human beings, are made in God's image, that their life is precious, that their life is to be protected. And to put it in sort of stark terms, that willfully to destroy an individual who carries this imago Dei is in some sense to spit in the face of the Almighty. It's an insult to the very being of God himself.
Yeah. And this takes us back to that initial image, you know, that kind of church historians and theologians have found, which is the language of, you know, the image bearer being the kind of image of the king sent to a distant province of the empire to act as the representative of the king. You know, if you are to, you know, if one community was to murder the diplomat who is acting as the image of the king, that would be treated as treason because this person is held to represent the very kind of power and authority and dignity of the king, no matter how far away they are, no matter how different they might look. And so an attack on them is considered to be a direct attack on the king himself.
Yeah, absolutely right. It's a very powerful analogy, isn't it? And therefore, you know, and again, as I've sometimes say, because Jesus was a baby, all babies are special. You know, all of a sudden, you know, all these little beings take on a kind of symbolism and a significance. They just can't be sort of discarded as being irrelevant. Because Jesus was a dying person, all dying people are special.
And beyond simply the kind of prohibition on murder and killing, I think there's also a broader question about dignity as well. In this, connected to that, is that beyond, it's not just that you shouldn't destroy the image of God or those who bear his image, but you also must treat them with dignity and respect. And I think that has massive implications for a lot of our ethics as a society, but particularly when it comes to medicine and things like assisted suicide and abortion, other questions like that, is a question of to what extent, it's not just about whether or not you end the life of people, but to what extent are we appropriately recognizing the inherent dignity of everyone who bears the image, that and in the same way that we would absolutely bear true respect and honor to God himself, we need to uphold the inherent dignity of his image bearers, as well as actively not seeking to destroy them.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that keynote of respect is something which I see as a distinctively Christian aspect of medical ethics. And it's, you know, it's the, there's a real difference between respect love and pity love. Often in healthcare, there's a kind of pity, you know, oh, you poor, pathetic, you know, individual, I'm here to love you and care for you. The trouble with pity love is, even while it's very caring, it sort of demeans you. It reduces your sense of identity and self-worth. Whereas to be treated with respect, to be treated as, you know, you are the same, you and I, you know, you are also a being made in God's image. I'm here to love you and care for you, but I respect you as someone equal in value to myself. That's a very different kind of love, and that's Christian love. That's what it should be. Sadly, so often in Christian history, pity love has replaced that kind of respect love.
And I suppose the second way in which this highfalutin theological discussion comes down to ground and is earth very, very, very meaningfully is, as we've discussed many times, this issue of human distinctiveness, which, you know, I think, as you said before, is kind of almost under attack from both ends, both how, in what sense are humans distinctive from high level software, machines, AI, robots, but also in what sense are humans distinct from, you know, sophisticated primates and other animals? You know, is the person just a highly sophisticated primate, or is it just a computer made of meat? And thinking through carefully what it means to be made in the image of God, I think has real direct relevance to understanding how we can defend, if we want to, human distinctiveness.
That's absolutely right. So it is a very interesting and troubling phenomenon, I think, in modern secular thinking, is that on the one hand, you have the animal kingdom and you look at, you know, all the different species and to the higher apes and so on. And so there's a kind of blurring of, from one end, what's really the difference? What does it mean to be human? And then you're having the other coming from the machinery and the AI. And again, what's really the difference? And so that, so much so that, that in contemporary secular thinking, it's quite hard to say, is there an essential difference between being human? Are we all really the same thing? Different forms of intelligence, different configurations of atoms. Yeah. You know, it's almost like that unique humanity just sort of disappears like a chimera. And it does feel, therefore, as though there is a kind of intellectual attack on human uniqueness. And it's often derided with this word essentialism. You know, essentialism has become a sort of academic dirty word, you know, whenever someone is, oh, you're just an essentialist, you know, which basically means you're pitiably ignorant about the nature of reality.
Yes, and there's a kind of progressive tinged flavour to some of this, because there's a belief that human essentialism is kind of the intellectual roots behind things like the ecological crisis, as we mentioned earlier, you know, this idea that humans are alone, have the power to subjugate and rule, but also, as you know, people have suggested, it's got roots behind kind of colonialism and imperialism, you know, when you deny the value of other species or other people that we would now see as people, that's kind of it's kind of derided as a kind of enabling philosophy for some of the worst aspects of human nature to come out and be given free rein.
Yeah, that's right. And so one way it's often expressed is, you know, well, of course, the moral community started with just a small coterie of white men who were the only people who were fully human. And then there were all these subhuman types. And then gradually the moral community extends to include all white men. And then it extends, so we might include some white women as well. And then it excludes further, you know, some people of colour. Mm. And now we've got to extend the moral community further to include primates and dolphins and elephants.
ChatGPT.
Even dogs and cats. And now ChatGPT, exactly. I mean, this is a caricature of history because, I mean, as we've already seen from the early Christian days, you know, abandoned babies were regarded as part of the moral community. So it's simply a rewriting of history that is not, it doesn't reflect reality at all. But I think what this understanding of the Imago Dei does is it does put a sort of shining line in some way around Homo sapiens.
But why is that so important? Why is it so important for Christians to defend the distinctiveness of Homo sapiens?
Well, I would want to do that on the basis of what we've just been looking at, this, you know, this understanding of creation, that it's God who's put the shining light line around the species Homo sapiens. I mean, this is derided by people like Peter Singer as speciesism.
Yeah.
This is simply to discriminate on the basis of species, which is a bad thing.
But just a different form of racism, in other words, yeah.
It's a different form of racism or ageism or whatever other kind of ism you don't like. But I would want to argue that, well, from the Bible and from Orthodox Christianity, God himself is irredeemably speciesist. And therefore, I would defend speciesism. That doesn't mean, again, that we abuse non-human species, that we treat them with contempt. But we want to maintain the distinctiveness that there is something constitutive about being human, which is different from being an elephant,
yeah,
or being ChatGPT.
And there's something else as well that I often feel when we have these conversations, particularly around, you know, the tech industry and modern technologists, which is that it strikes me that there is an attempt to kind of reduce what it means to be human to something which is, you know, fundamentally very technological. You know, it's, oh, we're just kind of processing machines. We're just doing code. We're just, you know, responding to stimuli just like any other kind of piece of software is. And there's this kind of bait and switch goes on where simultaneously they're trying to knock down what it means to be human to something kind of base and numerological and expressed in binary. And then a lot of these same people who are doing that are then overclaiming what computers can do to kind of claim that we're there or almost at some kind of singularity in which the distinction between human and machine has been obliterated. And even though I think that's in itself highly overblown and we're no way near AI being approaching kind of general intelligence and all that stuff, there's actually something important to defend about what it means to be human, that actually, no, we're not just computing machines made of cells as opposed to transistors. The Imago Dei tells us that actually there is something of God in us, something divine, something ineffable, something mysterious, something immaterial. And, you know, there's lots of Christian discussion about the souls and spirits and all that thing. But actually, the Imago Dei points us to the fact that to be, you know, Homo sapiens is not just, it's not just that God has just chosen one species and said they're special because I say they're special, but that because he's made them in his image in a way that no other species is, no other construction piece of technology is. And that means that you can't reduce what it means to be human down to something that is attainable by a robot, a machine, an AI.
Yeah, I've just been reading a book written by a secular philosopher of technology, and she bemoans the fact that whenever you put onto social media, you know, where someone's putting forward the great wonders of AI, or particularly these large language models, and whenever someone posts, you know, but a large language, don't forget that a large language model is a probabilistic next word, autoregressive next word predictor, that you could just guarantee that there's suddenly going to be a whole bunch of posts saying, you mean you don't realize that human beings are just simply probabilistic autoregressive next word predictors? And that's exactly the point you're making, Tim, isn't it? That,
yeah. That no, I'm not.
Once this...
I reject
yes,
it.
Yes, you are.
I reject it. I am more than just the next word generator.
Yeah, you just generated some next words, haven't you? You know, once you've got this very demeaning reductionist understanding of what it means to be human, then it becomes easier to value the machinery. Yeah. I do think there's a kind of deeper spiritual element behind all this. I mean, who is the one who is devoted to attack the image under every possible circumstances? And that's the evil one in the scriptures is seen as the one who is devoted to destroy and demean and attack and accuse and betray humanity, and this is a new form of that age-old attack on the Imago Dei.
And what I am encouraged by is that there seems to me to be running through kind of basic, unquestioned secular discourse outside of these kind of like philosophical ivory towers, a basic sense that, no, Peter Singer, you're just wrong. There is a difference between humans and animals, and no, technologist, techno-utopist, you're just wrong. There is a difference between AI and humans. And I think maybe this is one of the last remaining kind of deep-rooted residues of Christendom that I think the average person in a Western kind of post-Christian country, whether the UK, the US or somewhere else, I think the average person is still convinced. They couldn't justify it. They couldn't really explain it, but they are still convinced that there is something distinctive about human beings. That's why most of us aren't vegetarians, and we're happy to kill and eat animals for food, but we would be repulsed at the idea of doing that with humans. And that's why most of us still have a kind of uncanny, eerie feeling, you know, when we discover that, oh, that person on the other end of the chat window is actually a chatbot rather than a human being. Like, I just think there is an intuition which happens to, or maybe not happens to, does very obviously line up with a Christian understanding of human distinctiveness. And I find that an encouraging kind of bulwark against some of the more aggressive attacks on human distinctiveness that we've been talking about.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. It's something I've often seen in my own public debates, you know, with atheists and with other thinkers and just with people of the general public, that that if you want to argue on the basis of truth claims, you know, what is true, what does it mean to be human, well, who says, and what is truth anyway, you know, it seems like these truth claims have become so contested that it's very difficult to make anything based on truth claims. But when you appeal to human intuitions, time and time again, I find, well, you know, I can't really give you reasons for why that is, but somewhere deep down in my gut, I say that's just wrong. Mm. And so paradoxically, at this particular point in history, the general public's intuitions are more Christian, or more in favor of Christian ethics than people's rationality. Mm. However, I suspect that this is a historical phase, because those intuitions used to have a rational basis, and that rational basis has now gone. And we're already seeing areas where those intuitions are changing quite rapidly. And so I think it's a fragile basis on which to put your ethics. It's still
kind of
there.
Temporary overhang from Christendom, but it can't last too long once you've chiseled away the foundation.
I think that's right, and I think the AI is the next attack on the this human essentialism, and it's a profound attack. Yes, people's intuitions are, come on, it's just a machine. But once that machine becomes indistinguishable in the way that it responds, then I sort of say, oh, well, perhaps, you know, aren't I a machine anyway? What's the difference?
Hmm. It's that quote from Westworld you've mentioned many times, you know, where the sci-fi series some people might have seen, where, you know, someone comes across in this sci-fi world a person, and they say, are you one of them? Are you a kind of humanoid robot, or are you a real person? And she responds, if you can't tell the difference, why does it matter?
Exactly. And that is the question which is going to haunt us as we go into our AI future. But why it's really important, therefore, for those of us who want to be faithful to Orthodox Christian faith, to say, well, let's try to understand what is the difference.
Yeah. Good. Well, that seems like a neat place to come to an end. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. I hope that was an interesting conversation to eavesdrop along to. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts, your disagreements, suggestions for things we could discuss and think about future. You can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. You can also find plenty more resources around bioethics and some of the other stuff we've been discussing today at Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can sign up to my newsletter and find some of my journalism at my website, tswyatt.com. But we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.